1,000 prisoners of war from each country in exchange, which took place this weekend.
And you were there for this latest prisoner exchange. What? Tell us about that. What kind of condition were the Ukrainians in?
So, Michelle, they all looked sickly and gaunt. Their clothes were just hanging off them. Their heads were shaved. We don't know yet what these soldiers endured in Russian captivity, but other Ukrainians imprisoned by Russia have described horrific conditions. They were starved, beaten, and tortured.
And what was the scene as these soldiers came home?
Well, it was incredibly moving and also heartbreaking. Families were gathered in this leafy courtyard in northern Ukraine, waiting to see if their loved ones would be among the soldiers getting off these chartered buses. 18-year-old Milena Moroz held a photo of her father, who has been missing since February, and she broke down when we talked. She's saying, I wish I'd told him, I love you, Dad. When the buses carrying the soldiers arrived, the families rushed to hug them as they walked out. One young soldier, Anton Kobilnik, told us he'd been in captivity for 3 years. He's saying, I won't really feel like I'm at home until I see my mom. We only saw a handful of these reunions. However, Michelle, most family members were left waiting in tears, including 18-year-old Milena Moroz. Her father is still missing.
Oh, it's so tragic. That's NPR's Joanna Kakissis in Kyiv. Joanna, thank you.
You're welcome.
A federal judge has temporarily blocked the Trump administration's move to revoke Harvard University's ability to enroll international students, but the future remains uncertain. In recent days, we've been hearing from Harvard students and faculty. Today, Stephen Levitsky joins me. Levitsky conducts research on authoritarian governments and leads the David Rockefeller Center for Latin American Studies at Harvard. Stephen, you wrote in 2018 the book How Democracies Die, where you warned that the Trump administration was acting like an authoritarian government, and you say it's happening again. What's different, if anything, this time around?
Oh, this time is much, much more authoritarian. Trump, when he won the first time around, didn't expect to win, didn't have a plan, didn't have a team in place, and was compelled to govern with more or less mainstream Republicans and conservative technocrats, and they constrained him. Trump was always very authoritarian. His instincts were always very authoritarian, but he was surrounded by folks who largely constrained him. This time around, a very, very different story. Had a team, had a plan, put in place a government that did not, full of loyalists and people who have a very authoritarian agenda. And he's completely unconstrained in his authoritarianism, except for by the courts. So this is an all-out authoritarian assault, the likes of which we haven't seen in this country probably ever.
Are there any historical precedents with governments elsewhere trying to control schools in an authoritarian way? How do those moments compare to this one?
Frankly, this has been a more aggressive assault on universities than we've seen in other elected authoritarian governments in the 21st century. This is something that really all authoritarians do. Left-wing, centrist, right-wing. Autocrats don't like universities because universities are, in most countries, culturally influential centers of dissent. Universities are always voices of dissent. And so autocrats, whether it's right-wing autocrats in Hungary or left-wing autocrats in Nicaragua and Venezuela, almost invariably go after universities. This is straight out of the authoritarian playbook.
Now, the U.S. has a track record for attracting the best and brightest. Immigrants have won 40% of Nobel Prizes awarded to Americans between the year 2000 and 2023. That's according to analysis from the nonpartisan and nonprofit National Foundation for American Policy. Why go after, Stephen, universities, the institutions that actually attract these best and brightest minds?
Well, this is a government that is ethno-nationalist. It is turning inward. It's not interested in the kinds of international exchanges, trade, travel in and out of the country that governments in the United States consistently since World War II have engaged in. This is an inward-oriented government that is much more interested in consolidating power than in building capacity or building wealth for the future. I mean, trade policy is very similar. This is consistent with other policies. This is a government that is rapidly breaking what has made this country great since World War II.
How does a ban on international students impact Harvard and beyond? I know financially it would be a big hit, but I mean, what are the impacts that we're talking about here?
Financial is the least of it, quite frankly. We are an international university. We have 7,000 foreign students and a huge number of foreign visitors and professors. We've absolutely feed on international exchange, on the ability of our own members to travel abroad, to do research abroad, and to bring in the best and the brightest, again, scholars, students from every part of the world. That is what makes, in part, this country great, and it's what makes higher education in the United States great. We could not be Harvard, as we've known it since World War II, without international exchange. We would cease to be a great university almost overnight.
You teach international students at Harvard. What are they telling you about this moment?
They're terrified. About 80% of my students, of my graduate students, are international, most of them from Latin America. And they are, as you can imagine, suffering total uncertainty about their future. These are the folks who have spent years of their lives preparing for this, working to get into Harvard, to get a degree from Harvard, and don't know where they're going to be, whether they're going to be here in the fall. Their futures are completely up in the air. Many of them have challenging financial circumstances and are never imagined that they'd be faced with this challenge.
Stephen Levitsky is a professor of government and director of the David Rockefeller Center for Latin American Studies at Harvard. Stephen, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
In honor of Memorial Day, we ask listeners to share stories about service members and their families who lost their lives. We'll start with the story of Theodore King Higgins. While stationed in San Diego in 1964, he received Navy orders to go to Vietnam. Here's his daughter, Catherine, from Oregon.
He was lost at sea when his A-4 Skyhawk crashed into the sea while on approach to the USS Bonhomme Richard.
Catherine was 3 years old when her father died.
My mother always said that Ted was a true patriot, that he died for our country. And I don't remember my father, but I do know that he was smart and he was quiet, and he died so that Americans can live in freedom.
Hope Sutton from North Carolina remembers her father, Carl Sutton, and her grandfather, Hans George Fulton. She says her grandfather was a pacifist who volunteered to serve in World War II.
He was a mechanical engineer who led troops that went into towns after they were reclaimed.
Their job was to go around and find all of the booby traps or any types of explosives left behind by the Germans.
Sutton's father, Carl Sutton, served in the Army.
Although he did not fight in Vietnam, he was exposed to Agent Orange during his service, and he subsequently passed away from leukemia.
Kirsten Foster from Michigan spoke about her great uncle, Private First Class John Francis Rise. He lied about his age in order to serve in World War II, and he was just 16 years old.
He became a paratrooper.
He participated in the Battle of the Bulge and then unfortunately was killed in action during his first and last jump during Operation Varsity, which was the largest airborne operation of World War II. My family was only ever told that he was dead before he hit the ground.
Rise was 18 years old.
He was just a kid who was in an extraordinary situation and ended up paying the ultimate price because he thought it was the right thing to do. Great Uncle John is a hero who I hope many others will now be thinking about and remembering this Memorial Day.
These are just a few of the stories of the many service members we celebrate on this day. This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 8:19. Thank you so much for being here for the show on this Memorial Day Monday. Still to come this hour on the program, we're going to hear about the agriculture industry, obviously very important to a lot of people here in Wisconsin. That industry will be affected by tariffs, which a lot of people say are bad for agriculture. But the American sheep industry is cautiously optimistic. That story is still to come this hour on WPR.
PBS Wisconsin Education and the Wisconsin School Music Association have partnered with music educators to create ReSound, Songs of Wisconsin, a free collection of classroom media resources featuring contemporary Wisconsin musicians. The collection is designed to help general music educators and learners explore the connections between music, culture, identity, and emotion.
access lesson plans, and more. Visit pbswisconsineducation.org.
Support for WPR comes from Reynolds Residential Moving, dedicated to providing quality household moving and storage services throughout Wisconsin and North America. More information, including move estimates, at ReynoldsTransfer.com.
Support comes from the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center. Whether you need information about Medicare, housing options, home care, or accessible transportation, the ADRC is the place to start. Their services are free. Call 262-605-6646.
Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Mostly sunny across the state for Memorial Day today. High temperatures in the 60s and 70s. We could see increasing clouds later on today, but no rain expected. Overnight partly cloudy with low temperatures in the 40s and 50s. Highs in the 60s tomorrow with clouds building throughout the day. This is WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. On this Memorial Day, we remember an American soldier who suffered defeat. He's linked in history with an American known for victory. Jonathan Horn wrote a book about both of them, including the American known for glory.
Douglas MacArthur is perhaps one of the most famous generals in American history. And I think what he's most famous for are those three words he said when he was ordered to leave the Philippines in 1942 by President Roosevelt, "I shall return."
MacArthur was considered the greatest American soldier. At the start of World War II, he commanded U.S. forces in the Philippines, which were trapped by a Japanese attack. MacArthur was told to flee, so Japan would not enjoy a propaganda victory by capturing him.
But very little is known about the general who took command after Douglas MacArthur left. His name was General Jonathan Wainwright, and he also made a vow, and his vow was to stay with his men and share their fate, even when it meant becoming the highest-ranking American prisoner of World War II.
Years later, MacArthur did return with forces to the Philippines, but the heart of Jonathan Horn's book, The Fate of the Generals, is the general he left behind, with American troops who couldn't escape in 1942. Wainwright, like MacArthur, had come from a military family and embraced his duty to stay.
American and Filipino troops have retreated to a peninsula called Bataan, where they are basically facing starvation and siege. Very quickly, they have to go down to half rations and then eventually to quarter rations, which is about 1,000 calories a day. That's not enough to live healthily in bed all day, to say nothing of trying to fight in foxholes. And there's another island off the tip of Bataan called Corregidor, where the Americans have their headquarters in a tunnel. And this is where the Americans will make their last stand. And Bataan will surrender on April 9th, 1942. This is the largest surrender of American forces in history, nearly 80,000. In fact, the Japanese will bring Wainwright to a radio studio in Manila, where they force him to make a broadcast.
Yesterday, I tendered to Lieutenant General Connally, the Commander-in-Chief of the Imperial Japanese Forces in the Philippines, the surrender of the four harbor defense forts of Manila Bay.
How did Americans back home respond in 1942? They're losing this war to the Japanese. Things are going very badly, and suddenly there's one of their own generals who's being made to step up to the microphone. He's on the radio and surrendering.
Well, that's a great question, because Wainwright is very worried about what Americans back home will think of this decision that he made. In truth, he becomes a hero. Americans understand the difficult decision that he made. They know he fought to the very last chance he had. There were literally Japanese tanks pulling up to the entrance of the American headquarters and ready to proceed inside and carry out this massacre. So there really was no choice. And in fact, George Marshall back in Washington will make the proposal to give a Medal of Honor to Wainwright shortly after the surrender of the Philippines. And it would have gone forward, except one man said he would strongly speak out against it. And that man was Douglas MacArthur.
What?
Who had just received his own Medal of Honor.
For leaving.
Yes. General MacArthur was given a Medal of Honor when he reached Australia. And this is perhaps the most unusual Medal of Honor in American history. It was given to General MacArthur to offset Japanese propaganda about the captain deserting the sinking ship. General Marshall and President Roosevelt think about this, and they wonder how they can offset these charges that MacArthur has abandoned his forces in the Philippines. And what they come up with is to give MacArthur the one medal he's never received, the Medal of Honor.
And then MacArthur said, make sure not to give that medal to the guy that I left behind.
That is exactly what happens, and we have MacArthur's letter vetoing a Medal of Honor for General Wainwright. He says if it proceeds, he will be forced to release unsavory details about General Wainwright. And I think the implication here is that General Wainwright is an alcoholic.
Why did MacArthur care so much about denying an honor to the guy that he'd left behind?
MacArthur really was outraged that General Wainwright had made the decision to surrender the full Philippines. He seemed not to be able to process that Wainwright had done this because the Japanese were otherwise going to carry out a massacre in the American headquarters of 12 or 13,000 lives. But there was something larger. I think for MacArthur, the Medal of Honor always conjured the image of his father, who had received the Medal of Honor during the Civil War for charging up a ridge with the flag in his hand. And the thought of the medal going to someone who ordered the flag to be lowered at the sickening hour of surrender really struck MacArthur that he couldn't let that happen. And I think this was a great injustice, because what Wainwright did was every bit as heroic as anyone carrying the flag up a ridge. He stayed to see it lowered at the sickening hour of surrender when no one else wanted that job.
What was Wainwright's captivity like?
Well, so the Japanese had Wainwright as a prisoner of war, and they moved him from the Philippines to Taiwan, and eventually all the way to Manchuria, where he faces negative 49 degrees.
Hmm.
He's tortured. He is beaten. The Japanese engage in what Wainwright will describe as systematic starvation. And in June 1945, you can see in Wainwright's diary, his health is breaking down. He thinks the war might last for another 2 years. He's totally cut off from information from the outside world. And he thinks he's not going to make it. And he writes this very moving entry in his diary where he says, I fought for life in the Philippines, and I'm going to fight for life with everything I have now. And I think that gives you a sense of what kind of man General Wainwright was.
When you think about his character and his personality, few of us hopefully will ever be in that situation that he was in. But are there lessons that you draw that you find yourself wanting to apply in your own life or wishing other people would?
One of the lessons I drew from General Wainwright is the importance of keeping your word and honor. And anyone can see it on the first page of his diary that he starts on April 2nd, 1942, when he says no other course of action would be honorable but to stay with my men and share their fate. That's a real leader.
Jonathan Horn is the author of The Fate of the Generals, MacArthur, Wainwright, and the Epic Battle for the Philippines. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
After World War II, President Harry S. Truman gave Jonathan Wainwright the Medal of Honor he'd been denied during his captivity. This is NPR News.
In her debut novel, What Will People Think?, author Sarah Hamden wanted her main character, Mia, to be more than just a stereotype.
And I just wanted to see if it was possible to write a really great story that happened to feature a Palestinian woman who is American and messy and funny and real and not just reduced to these headlines.
I'm Elsa Chang. That conversation on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's that story plus the day's news from 4 until 6:30 on WPR.
This is WPR News.
Good morning. Thanks for spending some time here on this Memorial Day. It's Morning Edition on WPR, with news starting in just seconds.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump isn't ruling out new U.S. sanctions on Moscow following the latest Russian attacks in Ukraine. Hundreds of missiles and drones have been fired at Kyiv and other areas of the country over the last 3 nights. The strikes included the largest aerial drone assault of the war, killing at least 12 and injuring dozens. On social media yesterday, Trump said Putin, in his words, has gone absolutely crazy. A massive Republican budget bill that cleared the House by one vote last week is now in the hands of the Senate. The legislation reflects much of President Trump's legislative agenda, including an extension of tax cuts. Here's NPR's Amy Held.
The bill includes $3.8 trillion in tax cuts that skew to the wealthy and will add trillions to the deficit. That's a problem for fiscal hawks.
We have to reduce the deficit.
Senator Ron Johnson, Republican from Wisconsin, spoke to CNN.
We need to focus on spending, spending, spending.
The bill calls for about $1.5 trillion in spending cuts, largely on social safety net programs. House Speaker Mike Johnson tells CNN now is not the time for the Senate to meddle much with the bill.
Because remembering that we've got to pass it one more time to ratify their changes in the House, and I have a very delicate balance here.
Senate Majority Leader John Thune says they will put their stamp on the legislation. Amy Held, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. Hundreds of nurses at Unity Point Health Meritor Hospital in Madison say they'll go on strike this week after months of contract negotiations. The 5-day strike is scheduled to start tomorrow and last until June 1st. The union and hospital management will return to the bargaining table during the strike. A meeting is scheduled for later this week. The nurses, who are represented by SEIU Wisconsin, say demands around staffing levels and patient safety are not being heard. Hospital leaders disputed the union's characterization of negotiations, but said they are, quote, well prepared to continue caring for patients and maintaining operations during the strike. The small city of Hillsboro in western Wisconsin has been dealing with a shortage of child care options for local families. Now the community is partnering with a church, a local developer, and the state on a $1.2 million project to build a combination daycare and senior center to serve residents. City Administrator Josh Finch says there are no child care centers in Hillsboro and very few in a 40-mile radius.
Staff are sometimes having to make the decision of, do they take another job to get closer to child care, or do they quit entirely to be a stay-at-home parent?
The new center will be able to care for up to 33 children and will have space for a senior meal site and a place to gather. It's set to open in September. Two different container manufacturers in Wisconsin announced facility closures this month. The planned closures in Oconomowoc and Prairie du Chien are expected to leave about 100 workers without a job. Metal can maker Silgun Containers Manufacturing filed a layoff notice with the state last week. It plans to close a plant in Oconomowoc that employs 56 people. It says layoffs are expected to begin in July. Earlier this month, packaging and containers manufacturer Truvant North America announced it would close one of its facilities in Prairie du Chien. The closure is expected to result in 44 people losing their jobs. That plant is expected to close mid-July. In weather, high temperatures in the 60s and 70s with plenty of sunshine during Memorial Day today. More news at WPR.org. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
Enemy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. President Trump's trade wars have made it harder for agricultural producers to turn a profit. It's raised the costs of imported fertilizers and disrupted the markets abroad where they sell. But as Ray Solomon from member station KUNC reports, the sheep industry is cautiously optimistic.
Lorray Moon geeks out over sheep more than most.
I love them so much. I just kept buying sheep. So I'm in a Sheep Buyers Anonymous program.
These days, she keeps the herd to a modest 80 head spread across the family ranch on the outskirts of Craig, Colorado. She's also got a wool mill packed with machinery that combs and spins raw fleece, shorn right off the sheep into soft, finger-pleasing yarn. From birthing the lambs to attaching labels on the yarn, she does it all.
We kind of base this whole company on doing what we could do right here close.
Her business doesn't really touch international markets at all. Even so, when Trump unveiled his sweeping 10% tariffs on foreign trade last month, she perked up.
I feel like it's an upswing for us.
Sheep producers are excited about the tariffs. The American Sheep Industry Association says the U.S. sheep industry is worth $5.1 billion, but has been in decline for decades. Cheaper imports from Australia and New Zealand are now three-quarters of the market. Mike Harper owns one of the country's largest sheep feedlots in Eaton, Colorado. He says at this point, American lamb is considered a premium product. The problem is that it looks too expensive to U.S. consumers used to cheap foreign imports.
Their undercutting is pretty substantially in pricing. The imports are.
The industry endorsed the tariffs on Australia and New Zealand, calling the 10% tax a good first step toward leveling the playing field for American producers. Harper says he's all for pricier imports, but these 10% tariffs aren't the ones he was hoping for.
It's probably not enough to make us competitive. If they'd have come out at 25 or 30%, I think that would have been impactful.
Harper says he's also worried about a bigger front in the current trade wars, China. He used to send his sheepskins there for processing. With the constantly changing tariff situation, he's not sure what he's going to do.
I mean, we can't just flip the switch and start doing it all here domestically. We're not set up for it.
But the outlook could be rosier down the line, according to Colorado State University ag economist Dom Thilmany.
If Australian and New Zealand wool and lamb look more expensive, you might actually see the supply of American sheep producers go up.
She says the laws of supply and demand tell us that if American sheep production ramps up, domestic prices would come down, possibly even enough to outcompete the imports. But
given it takes a while to raise a lamb into a marketable sheep, you're probably talking at least a 2 to 3 year lag.
And even then, Thilmany says sheep are just a tiny part of a massive economy rocked by tariffs.
It's an industry that's maybe 5% the size of the cattle industry. So sheep will see a relatively better day. It's just not going to be nearly enough to offset the shocks to all the other parts of the ag sector.
The biggest winners in these trade wars might just be the smallest, most locally oriented producers, like Lorray Moon in her artisan wool mill. The way she sees it, the tariffs are changing the very conversation around consumption in her favor.
People are saying, well, I might buy less yarn, but I'm going to buy a really good one, and I'm going to know the farmer, and I'm going to know its story.
Which means her sheep obsession could finally pay off in the marketplace. For NPR News, I'm Ray Solomon in Craig, Colorado.
In about 24 states, immigrant students who have protection under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA program, can pay in-state tuition for college, which can mean big savings. But amid a broader crackdown on illegal immigration, that discount is at risk. From member station WUSF, Nancy Guan reports that Florida is getting rid of the benefit.
In the hallway of Seminole State College in Sanford, Florida, Hernan stares at the photos of alumni hanging on the walls.
They're pretty professional people. She graduated in 2018. Maybe one day I'll be here too.
Hernan asked that we not use his last name because he fears being targeted for his immigration status. His family brought him to the U.S. from Mexico as a child, and he has protection under DACA, but the program is facing court challenges. Hernan is a junior studying construction management. He's worked in landscaping since he was 16, and says a bachelor's degree will get him further in his career.
I will need this for hire, like manager or even corporate positions, like up there. I feel that if I don't have this right now, I can't begin my life.
He needs about 9 more classes in order to graduate. But a new state law scheduled to go into effect later this year could delay Hernan's future. The law gets rid of a waiver that has allowed students with DACA protections to pay the same in-state tuition rate as their U.S. citizen peers if they attended a Florida high school for 3 years. These students can't access federal financial aid or state aid in most cases. When lawmakers created the waiver a decade ago, they believed it would give young people like Hernan a chance at higher education. But attitudes have changed.
It is immoral to charge people who shouldn't even be in the country a vastly discounted price.
That was former Florida State Senator, now Congressman Randy Fine, speaking at a committee meeting in January. He and other lawmakers who supported eliminating the tuition benefit argue that it encourages illegal immigration. And now thousands are at risk of losing the waiver, according to Florida's university and college systems. Diego Sanchez is with the President's Alliance on Higher Education and Immigration, a group that tracks these tuition policies.
They didn't just block future students. They basically pulled the rug out from under students who are already enrolled, already paying, who relied on this waiver, and many who were already on track to graduate.
Sanchez says Republican legislatures in at least 3 states with in-state tuition for DACA students have also tried to reverse their policies this year. But so far, Florida is the only one that succeeded. Hernan says he's expecting his tuition to triple. To finish his remaining courses, it'll cost him about $15,000 instead of $4,000. But he smiles and says he's staying positive.
We just gotta adapt. That's one of my favorite words, adapt. I gotta adapt to the changes, you know, in current society, you know.
He says he's thinking about applying for private scholarships or loans that can cover the extra costs, or maybe taking a year off to work full-time and save up.
I consider the state my home, and it will be my home until the last stage, you know, where they kick me out, where they deport me. But as far, I'm gonna keep fighting.
Fighting, he says, for whatever it takes to earn his degree. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Guan in Sanford, Florida.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 8:42. Glad you could join us for the show this morning. Still to come this hour on the program, we'll hear a story that comes to us from Major League Baseball. There is a new bat that is being used by at least one special team in particular, and it's leading towards a whole lot of home runs and some controversy as well. That story is a few minutes away, plus, of course, news at 9 here on WPR News.
Clarence King was a brilliant scientist and witty conversationalist. He was a best-selling author and architect of the great surveys that mapped the West after the Civil War. But King hid a secret from his Gilded Age friends. He lived a double life as the celebrated white Clarence King and as a black Pullman porter and steelworker. Join us for Passing Strange, tonight at 9:30 on Chapter a Day.
Support for WPR comes from HGA, a national multidisciplinary design firm dedicated to sustainable building practices. Offices in Madison, Milwaukee, and across the country. More at hga.com.
Support comes from Casey Family Options Funerals and Cremations, a tradition of trust, serving families in southeast Wisconsin. For more information, including how to get started in pre-planning, visit caseyfamilyoptions.com or call 262-653-0667.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio at 8:44. Here's a look at what's happening in news. Russia overnight launched the biggest drone attack on Ukraine in the more than 3-year war and included 355 drones and 9 cruise missiles. This comes after U.S. President Donald Trump said that Russian leader Vladimir Putin has gone, quote, crazy by stepping up the bombing. The Dane County Sheriff's Office says it has recovered a body from Lake Monona in the search for a missing boater. Hundreds of nurses at Unity Point Health Narrator Hospital in Madison say they will go on strike this week after months of failed contract negotiations. And after 133 years, Northland College in Ashland had held its last commencement ceremony for graduates this past weekend. More news at WPR.org. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From National Geographic Lindblad Expeditions, committed to taking travelers deeper into the wonders of planet Earth. Each expedition cruise is guided by a diverse team. NatGeoExpeditions.com/cruises. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. Torpedo baseball bats hit it big when the New York Yankees set a new team record with 9 home runs in a game early this season. People noticed the oddly shaped bats that seemed to give players more pop at the plate. Alana Schreiber with member station WWNO in New Orleans visited one of the companies making bats that are all the rage.
I'm in heaven. This is a baseball lover's dream.
I'm standing in a conference room at Marucci Sports in Baton Rouge. Bats line the walls all the way up to the ceiling. They're one of the top companies making these new torpedo bats. I'm with Kurt Ainsworth, co-founder and CEO. Even he was amazed at how much people were talking about these bats.
It was not your normal just ESPN or MLB Network talking about baseball. It was people with Fox News and CNN talking about baseball. So it became everybody that's not even baseball fans know about torpedo.
Anyone who looks at a torpedo bat can tell. What makes them unique is their shape.
I mean, it looks like a bowling pin. I mean, they call it a torpedo because it sounds cooler, but it really does look like a bowling pin.
Traditional bats get bigger the higher up you go. But torpedo bats bulge out about 3/4 of the way up and thin out at the top. In other words, there's a bigger sweet spot.
It's basically taking the girth and the size of the end of the bat and moving it into the hitting space, so it gives the player a better chance for success.
So let's say a major leaguer wants a torpedo bat. First, he comes to Baton Rouge. Here, he'll meet with Micah Gibbs at Marucci's Baseball Performance Lab. He's worked with some of the MLB's biggest stars.
Paul Goldschmidt, Nolan Arenado, Alex Bregman, Francisco Lindor.
Gibbs says a lot goes into finding the perfect bat for a player.
We have a fitting matrix. We have a bunch of different bats, different weights, weight distributions. We put them through an entire physical assessment before they even start swinging.
But once they do start swinging, Gibbs takes a video, and a computer analyzes the player as they hit. Wherever they make the most contact, that's where the bat will be thicker.
So the bats come in as a billet of wood, and we will cut it into the shape of the bat, whatever that player specified for their bat.
That's Sager Allen, a wood operator. He's showing me the factory side of the business, where they cut and sand every bat.
We have, I want to say, over 70,000 different models we can cut and make, so there's definitely an art form to it.
After the bats are cut, sanded, and weighed, they head over to the painting department, where they're eventually inscribed with the player's often illegible signature. Then they're shipped to the athletes to test out. But I wanted to test out these bats, too. We head to Marucci's on-site batting cages, the same ones where major leaguers are getting fitted. But I'm not worried. I've played 2 seasons in an adult softball league. I've brought along Marty Sullivan. He's an LSU sports reporter, and today, my pitcher. He starts throwing, and I start swinging.
It's always more of an opposite field kind of hitter.
And you can feel it. The sweet spot is bigger. So big, in fact, that earlier in the season, some wondered if the bats might get banned. But Tyler Kepner, senior baseball writer for The Athletic, isn't too worried.
I think it's just an innovation for the hitters, honestly. And we've seen a lot of advancements the last few years in pitching technology. And so I think this is just one time when the hitters are fighting back a little bit.
In other words, baseball is constantly evolving. And these torpedo bats are just the latest innovation in pushing the limits of the game. For NPR News, I'm Alana Schreiber in Baton Rouge.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. Happy to have you with us at 8:49. Thanks for being here. A couple more stories to get to this hour here on the program, including one, a collage of some of the commencement addresses that were given throughout the past couple of weeks as we are fully into graduation season right now and getting ready to head into summer. Plus news coming up at 9 o'clock, and you can always find news at WPR.org.
I'm Gregory Berg. And on Tuesday's morning show here on WGTD, we're going to be hearing from a former Navy SEAL, Eric Greitens, who has written a really interesting and potentially helpful book about the quality of resilience and how essential it is for any of us to live a successful and happy life. His book is titled Resilience, Hard-Won Wisdom for Living a Better Life. Tuesday's morning show begins just after 8.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. In sports, the Milwaukee Brewers got a win over the Pittsburgh Pirates yesterday. The Brewers are currently sitting at third place in the division. They're tied with the Cincinnati Reds. They're about 4 games back of the Cardinals and 6.5 games back of the Chicago Cubs. The Brewers open up an interleague series against the Boston Red Sox today. First pitch from Milwaukee is set for 1:10. In weather, high temperatures expected to get into the 60s and 70s on this Memorial Day. Plenty of sunshine expected as well. Some clouds could start building later on into tonight. Partly cloudy overnight, but still dry. No rain expected with lows into the 40s and 50s. Mostly cloudy tomorrow with highs in the 60s. A little bit cooler near Lake Michigan. We could also see some spotty rain showers as we start to head into Tuesday night. This is WPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Ukraine controls just a third of its eastern province of Donetsk. One holdout town has been under constant Russian assault since 2014. But many residents of Slovyansk are determined to stay. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley visited the last maternity ward in a region surrounded by Russian forces.
Sounds of new life resound through the hallways of Slovyansk City Hospital, which has the last working maternity ward in Ukrainian-held Donbass.
Hello.
Meet pediatrician and hospital director Volodymyr Ivanenko. A large map of Ukraine hangs on the wall over his desk. He says when Russia invaded in 2022, many staff members fled, but almost everyone's returned, working through missile strikes and electricity and water cuts.
We are a Ukrainian health institution and must provide care until the last moment. Whether it's dangerous or not is another issue. It's a job, just like sitting in a trench. You have to work for something.
In room number 9, new mother Anastasia holds her one-day-old daughter, Vasilisa. It's a private moment she's happy to share briefly, but doesn't want to give their family name. She also has a 1.5-year-old. She wants to stay in this town where she grew up and her whole family still lives.
It's always better to be at home than somewhere else.
For now, she doesn't have to explain the daily sirens to her children or why some buildings in town lie in rubble. I ask the young mother if she'd prefer Slovyansk be under Russian or Ukrainian control. Some Ukrainians in the East have traditionally felt closer to Russia than Kyiv, though that has changed since the war.
I don't care what kind of peace we have. I just want my children to live with nothing flying over their heads.
The doctor who's been showing us around pulls me aside. Valentina Fushenko says this question of Russia or Ukraine ripped families apart in 2014 when Kremlin-backed separatists briefly took over Slovyansk.
And when the 2022 invasion came, it was a total catastrophe. But to try not to hurt or offend, we don't have these conversations anymore. Everyone just tries to live their life.
Plushenko says people hold on as long as possible because going somewhere else means paying rent.
Are you from Slovyansk?
No, from Kramatorsk.
Kristina Dyshenko from nearby Kramatorsk says her contractions have begun. Her husband, Valentin, says he's worried about the safety of their first child.
Nothing good will happen to Donetsk. We're going to have to leave.
The couple wants to move to a safer place like the Kyiv suburbs. Dyshenko says before President Trump was elected, he thought Ukraine would keep part of Donetsk province in a peace settlement. But now he thinks Trump and Russia will take it away. All hope is gone, he says. Little kids frolic in a playground next to the Slovyansk town hall, whose entrance is buttressed by sandbags. Out front are giant portraits of the town's sons who've fallen in battle. Five-year-old Artem plays cops and robbers as his father, Dmitry Klyuchnikov, looks on. Air raid sirens begin to go off. I ask if his son knows what's going on.
Yes, he knows the Russians are bombing us. He hates them. They're the bad guys.
So will they stay?
I understand they want Donetsk. And if for any reason they get it, we will leave.
They have killed so many people, says Klyuchnikov. We will never live in the country of the killers. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Slovyansk, Ukraine.
It's graduation season, the time for seniors to don their hard-earned caps and gowns and celebrate.
That also means commencement addresses from politicians, entertainers, activists, and Kermit.
You're all here to listen to a frog in a very tiny cap and gown give a commencement speech.
Kermit the Frog spoke at the University of Maryland's commencement about working with people to get ahead.
Rather than jumping over someone to get what you want, consider reaching out your hand and taking the leap side by side, because life is better when we leap together.
Actress Jennifer Coolidge told the graduates at Emerson College to be, well, delusional about their dreams.
My mother had a magazine in the living room, and it had Grace Kelly on the cover, and inside there was a full photo spread of her lavish royal wedding and a story about how she became the Queen of Monaco. And it was all in this moment that I realized that I wanted to be Queen of Monaco.
And her advice about how to go about reaching a dream?
When you find the thing that you want to do, I really want to highly recommend just frigging go for it.
Now, some speakers took a political tack, like actor and activist Jane Fonda. She urged the class at the USC Annenberg School of Communication to use their rights to guard against polarization, uncertainty, and climate change.
Vote all the way down the ballot. That means don't forget the sheriff, the school board, public utilities, the city council. You would be amazed at how much power these down-ballot offices can wield when it comes to democracy and climate.
Take a look, it's in a book, a reading rainbow.
Reading Rainbow's LeVar Burton offered this counsel to students at Howard University about navigating what he sees as the promises and prejudices of the United States.
Only in America could a descendant of slaves for whom simply knowing how to read just a few generations ago, a crime punishable by whipping or death, could grow up and become a celebrated champion for literacy and the written word. This, too, is America.
And he encouraged the graduates to use their gifts to build a brighter future.
Use them liberally and to your best advantage, and know in your heart of hearts that in the words of one of my very favorite wordsmiths, Kendrick Lamar, we gonna be all right.
We gonna be all right. We gonna be all right.
Congratulations to all the graduates. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Amy Martinez.
And when I wake up, I recognize you're looking at me for the pay cut. Bahamas, I'll be looking at you from the face down.
Not a bad way to end the show this morning. Thanks so much for joining us for Morning Edition here on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 1 minute before 9 o'clock now, with news from NPR and WPR on the way.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin-Madison, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, in Racine, a community composting program operates two drop-off sites year-round for your food waste. For more information on Facebook, go to Zero Waste Racine and join the group.
Your gateway to public radio is WGTD HD1.